court will proceed to the fifth case of the day, Farrell v. Butler University. Mr. Sutherland.
Good morning.
Please, the court, counsel. Plaintiffs contend that the but-for test is gone, and the trial court misapplied the Title VII summary judgment standard. Butler University has chosen to attack the messenger and disparage her evidence. Professor Farrell has shown that Butler University has maintained a pervasive climate of gender discrimination manifest by pay disparity, lack of mentoring and support for female candidates and staff and faculty, and an unlikely disparity in approval of tenure track faculty when comparing men and women. On appeal, Professor Farrell has two issues and two claims. Her first, of course, is the disparate treatment claim. Under the controlling case law, which we have cited in our briefs, beginning with the Desert Palace case, referring to the Nancy Spiegela case, most recently the Boyd case, and then referring as well to the Seventh Circuit cases of Hennessy and Ventor, we believe that this circuit has chosen to clarify and to set a course that is unambiguous as to how a plaintiff must prove and what burden that plaintiff must meet to demonstrate that they are the victims of discrimination under Title VII, where they contend that they had a disparate impact based upon their gender.
I want to ask you a question about this award, because it's not like a traditional raise, because for most faculty people it's not normal, nor is it expected. Why should we consider this award a raise rather than a bonus?
Judge Williams, that's a good question. The trial court addressed that and concluded, of course, that it was straddling both the bonus and the raise issues, and came to the conclusion that it was a raise. In this particular case, it's a one-time award, and what happens is if that person is selected as a candidate or as a recipient of the PEP award, they get an automatic 10% increase of their base salary, and that carries forward, and that has enormous implications because it's permanent, not just for their active teaching career, but also in retirement. So the calculation can be $1 million if a person lives a long time.
Well, what's the difference between that and an advanced degree then, Mr. Sutherland, and its impact on your status, you know, on your pay scale status within a university?
In other words, if a person obtained an advanced degree and they'd automatically get?
Yeah, because, you know, it qualified you for an associate professorship or whatever. I mean, what I'm just trying to track along with Judge Williams' question, what the effect of the
okay? Well, this is not an automatic increase. This is a merit increase based upon what we believe to be should have been objective criteria, comparing that person's candidacy portfolio to a candidacy seeking tenure. And in fact, if you look at the language in the given by all the deponents, they said, reflecting what was said in the criteria for the award, you should look at the candidate's merits based upon the same criteria that you would consider that candidacy for tenure. And so not everybody makes tenure. In fact, one of the things we pointed out to provide some context and background for this court or the trial court to understand the pervasive gender discrimination climate that existed there is that there's a disparity in the hiring of women. There's a disparity in pay. There were two studies that demonstrated that. There were disparity in mentoring and support. And there was a disparity of almost 66% when comparing men and women who were seeking tenure. So it's not an automatic award, and it's not an automatic assumption that you would get this particular award. It's a one-time award. So I hope that answers your question.
What authority does the official university have as opposed to this faculty committee that decides who gets the award?
That's an agency question, which we felt was sort of a sub question that didn't really need to be addressed fully. But we'll address it as best we can. The university, of course, can only deal through its faculty and its administrators, and through the governance process. There is a joint governance arrangement, if you will, in most universities between the administrative body and the faculty. In this particular case, and in most universities, there's a senate or governing body. But the fiscal responsibility is always left with the administration. So while they created this PEP award, they left it to each school to create its own different criteria. And the School of Liberal Arts and Sciences came up with a criteria which was similar to a tenure application. But we deposed the provost, Mr. Berry, and he said, as everyone else did, that the ultimate decision and approval rested with the administration. They funded it. They approved the criteria, and they could reject any candidacy. And in fact, after 2 years, this particular award was withdrawn.
Could the faculty have recommended a person A for this award, and the university disagreed and give the award to person B?
Sure. In the deposition,
had they ever done anything like that?
Well, it's only been in existence 2 years, so it's hard to develop a statistical basis. But there have clearly been other cases where a person has been recommended for award, and all of a sudden he shows up on the front page charged with a felony. That award is not going to be given.
Well, that's a different story.
Well, it is different, but it shows the criteria, the control that the university has. They have the ultimate veto authority. They have the prerogative to withdraw approval. And they did, in this particular case, when they ran out of money. They eventually tried to reinstate it, but that's not part of the record. But at that time, they conceded that they had the authority to disapprove of any recommendations. Now, that's not likely, because the protocol and the politics of any university is not going to show any disrespect or disregard for a careful process. But they had that authority, Judge Evans. So, in this particular case, we believe that by indirect evidence, applying what we believe are the standards enunciated in Desert Palace and in Boyd and in the Spiegel case, we have to extrapolate because the Spiegel, as you know, was a First Amendment case. But since that decision was reviewed by the entire Seventh Circuit panel of 11 judges and, I believe, 3 inactive judges, it has the essential imprimatur that we would assume will be imposed upon all the district court decisions regarding this case. And as we cited in our brief, there are a number of Title VII cases, not First Amendment cases, which have seen the comparisons and the parallels and have decided to apply the Spiegel standard, which means that if Grace Farrell were tested under the Spiegel standard or the Desert Palace standard or the Boyd standard, or if the language found in Venter were applied, or the review of what constitutes a mixed motive case, that any reasonable suggestion that sex was a motivating factor, she should have prevailed at the trial court level on summary judgment. In this particular year of 2005, we have an opportunity to reflect upon some serious studies that have been made by the ABA and other organizations about the number of trials that are going forward. 1.3% of all cases filed go to trial, an enormous statistic that has enormous impacts on whether or not we're giving people an opportunity to have their day in court. First claim, the desperate treatment claim, we went through an exhaustive analysis of how each of these candidates did not match up to the meritorious candidacy portfolio of Professor Farrell. Many of the deponents reflected that her scholarship was clearly superior to, if not superior to, all the candidates that had, in fact, applied. They found that her teaching, while it was supposed to be a lifetime award, her teaching was comparable, but the alternative grading or compilation of her teaching evaluations was apparently not considered. There is not a single deponent that could recall seeing this, although they said they remembered it being discussed. So we believe that, like a lot of situations, when you're now holding up the mirror to the panel, you find that they probably didn't see the same things that they now are looking at. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Just one thing, Mr. Sutherland. The award was in existence 2 years before the one in question. I mean, I understand that 2000 is time barred, but it's relevant for other purposes.
There was an award in 2000 and 2001.
So this is the 2002 award that you're.
Yeah, there were only two awards.
Yeah.
So.
Now,
or two, it, two it,
clearly
period.
Dr. Ferrell has impressive credentials, but in the 2002, the one you would be focusing on, she hasn't questioned, or you don't question, the credentials of the other candidates. Is that right?
We did. Yeah, we went through the whole thing. We outlined the credentials of all five recipients. We didn't review the credentials. Maybe I misunderstood. Of the other candidates, I think there were eight men that applied.
Yeah.
We did not review those. We just reviewed those of those that received the award. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Conrad.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Julie Conrad, and I'm counsel for Butler University in this case. In this case, the district court's entry of summary judgment should be affirmed for numerous reasons. With regard to her disparate treatment claim, first, the denial of the PEP award was not an adverse employment action within the meaning of Title VII, and therefore she cannot establish a prima facie case of disparate treatment. Second, Dr. Ferrell has failed to show that the reasons that the selection committee members gave for choosing the award recipients that they did were pretextual. She's also failed to show that gender was anyway a motivating factor in the selection committee's decisions. In fact, the evidence shows that the selection committees used a balanced and thoughtful process in selecting the candidates that they did. Dr. Ferrell's claims regarding the 2000 award, likewise, are barred because she failed to timely file a charge of discrimination within 300 days after learning that she had been denied the award. With regard to Dr. Ferrell's disparate impact claim, summary judgment should also be affirmed. First, Dr. Ferrell has not presented a prima facie case of disparate impact because she cannot show that the eligibility requirements that she challenges actually excluded her from consideration. In fact, the evidence shows she was considered both years for the award. Second, she cannot show that the selection committee's alleged use of certain criteria were actually employment practices under Title VII, which is required to show disparate impact. Last, Dr. Ferrell's disparate impact claim exceeds the scope of her charge and therefore is barred for that reason as well. I'd like to turn first to the fact that the PEP award, the denial of the PEP award was not an adverse employment action. As you commented, the PEP resembles a bonus. It does not resemble a raise. This award was for excellent performers. It was for tenured faculty who had exhibited sustained excellent performance. It was not like a raise for someone who performed satisfactorily.
But what about the fact that it was, you know, a permanent increase in salary so that, you know, it does become more like a raise rather than a bonus? And it was a permanent increase which, you know, just went on as long as you were in the position.
While it's true that there was a monetary aspect to the award, the fact of the matter is many of the qualities of the award more clearly resemble a bonus as opposed to a raise. For example, obviously the PEP award was not automatic for all those faculty members who were eligible or who even applied for the award. Obviously the number of eligible employees or faculty members could change from year to year. The number of people who applied for the award could change from year to year. Those are all unpredictable, irregular qualities. The award was discretionary in that the selection committees had the discretion to choose the most deserving candidate. Also, the evidence shows that the task force that created this award did not see this as a raise. In fact, the task force recommended numerous ways to increase faculty salary, including an annual raise, an evaluation process, and they also recommended salaried floors. So clearly the task force saw the PEP as something above and beyond a raise, a bonus, an award for excellent performers. Turning to the question of pretext, Dr. Ferrell attempts to argue pretext by showing that her qualifications, or by comparing her qualifications for those to those of the award winners. But this court's held that evidence of competing qualifications is not enough to show pretext unless those qualifications are so superior that no reasonable person could have picked the award winners over Dr. Farrell. And in fact, in this case, Dr. Farrell herself testified that the other candidates were comparable. She described them as fine teachers and fine scholars.
And you were referring to our Millbrook case, right? With
yes.
that quote?
Yes, ma'am. At her deposition, she did not want to point to deficiencies in their records. In any event, the fact that Dr. Farrell's own opinion that she's the best qualified candidate is not evidence of pretext, that was also a holding of the Millbrook case. Moreover, she hasn't presented any evidence that the selection committee lied about their reasons for selecting the award winners. The selection committees all testified that they discussed all the candidates and their dossiers, that after reviewing the accomplishments in all three areas, teaching, service, and scholarship, the selection committee members testified to legitimate non-discriminatory reasons for choosing the award winners that they did. And in fact, in both years, the selection committee members testified that Dr. Farrell's service was weak as compared to the award winners. In any event, this court has repeatedly held that it will not second-guess expert decisions of faculty committees, but also it will not second-guess an employer's business judgment. And that's exactly what Dr. Farrell is asking you to do. She's asking you to second-guess both selection committees, despite the fact that Dr. Susan Neville, a colleague of Farrell's, also an English professor, and a female selection committee member on both selection committees, testified there was no gender discrimination. In addition, Dr. Farrell's claim went to a faculty grievance committee where there were both male and female faculty members, and that grievance committee found there was no gender discrimination. She's also asking you essentially to second-guess that decision as well, and there's just no evidence of pretext. With regard to this mixed motive argument that Dr. Farrell's making, I'd add that it's in her reply brief for the first time that she argues the case should be remanded because the district court used the wrong standard, that they used the but-for instead of the mixed motive standard. She did not raise this issue in her statement of issues in her original brief, wherein she merely argued that the district court erred in finding that there wasn't any evidence of pretext. And I would submit it's too late to raise that issue now. And I would also submit that Dr. Farrell's failed to show that the district court actually did use the wrong standard. But regardless, even if you applied the motivating factor analysis in this case, the outcome does not change because she has not shown any evidence that gender was a motivating factor in either of the selection committee's decisions. Her argument that there were studies throughout the years that discussed salary disparity and tenure decisions, she has in no way linked those studies to the selection committee decisions. In fact, Grace Farrell herself was hired with full tenure at Butler and is one of the highest paid professors in LSA and the highest paid professor in the English department. In fact, the reports themselves, even if you were to consider them, and we've objected to the admission of some of them, don't establish that Butler University engaged in gender discrimination. But the bottom line is there's no link between these reports, one of which came out after both awards were given, and the selection committee's decisions not to give her the award. Furthermore, the fact that she argues that they did not, that the selection committees did not consider this alternate submission that she provided regarding her teaching evaluations. The evidence shows, and every single one of the selection committees testified that they considered the entire dossier. There's Dr. Farrell does not argue that these spreadsheets they looked at contained inaccurate information. She merely argues that they didn't consider an additional supplemental document she had, when in fact the committee, as I stated, testified they reviewed the entire dossier and that they took into account the fact that for personal reasons she had had fewer classes taught during the period in question that all the candidates needed to submit information. In addition, as I stated in the beginning, any claim regarding her 2000 award, disparate treatment, or disparate impact is time-barred because she waited until well after 300 days of learning of the denial of the award to file a charge. And as you know, the time limit begins to run when the defendant takes the action that injured the plaintiff, not when she knows she's been injured. But in this case, she clearly knew she was injured at least by April of 2000. Turning to her disparate impact claim, we also argue that summary judgment should be affirmed on this claim. First of all, Farrell can't challenge the eligibility requirements because she was eligible for the award, she applied for the award, and she was considered for the award. Second, Dr. Farrell can't challenge the alleged criteria used by the selection committees constituted employment practices. For example, the fact that one selection committee member decided to value achievements at Butler over achievements at other institutions, or the fact that one selection committee member may have not reviewed her supplemental information regarding her teaching evaluations. Those are not employment practices within the meaning of Title VII and within the meaning of disparate impact cases. Last, Dr. Farrell's disparate impact claim should be barred because it's the outside of the scope of the charge upon which she bases her lawsuit. There's no claim in her charge that a neutral practice had a disparate impact on women at Butler University. She argues that her charge questionnaire should control, but in fact, case law says that it's the charge, not the charge questionnaire, that should govern. For all these reasons, we would submit that summary judgment in this case should be affirmed on all of Dr. Farrell's claims.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Conrad. Mr. Sutherland?
No more time.
Mr. Sutherland, you had used up all your time, but I'm going to extend you a minute for rebuttal.
A minute. Okay, thank you. Let me address the last issue about impact, desperate impact, and pretext. The grievance committee undertook to consider the very limited information that she was allowed to present. And Professor Flusbaum unequivocally said in her deposition she found no way to support the choices of that committee with regard to scholarship and the stated criteria of the award. So it is pretextual. We've made our case out. And I think under Boyd, the standard should be any reasonable inference. Remember, she was the only woman that was technically eligible, but the evidence was that she wasn't even listed, so the university didn't even put her on the list. The evidence most favorable to the plaintiff, the non-moving party, is that the committee could not recall any of the significant merits of her candidacy, such as an NEH grant, the only one that anybody ever had. So if you're on the list and you show up, but nobody, in fact, remembers that you applied, you're not really there. We believe, since the trial court didn't consider standing, that the implication is that standing was there because of the conflicts in evidence. Right. There are no other questions?
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Sutherland.
Thank you, Judge.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advice.